From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Each week, I choose interesting articles that I think are relevant to our practices. And this week, I've chosen to review a 2018 European Heart Rhythm Association practical guide on the use of non-vitamin K antagonists in patients with atrial fibrillation. With the rapid development and diffusion of non-vitamin K anticoagulation agents, we are faced with a number of patients in our practice where interesting questions emerge, and I think this practical guide is very, very useful. So I'm going to go through about 10 key points to remember that I think are very relevant to our practices. First, the use of non-vitamin K antagonists, or I'll call them NOACs, is currently contraindicated for atrial fibrillation in patients with mechanical prosthetic valves or moderate to severe mitral valve stenosis, which is usually rheumatic. Although there is limited data in the trials for bioprosthetic aortic valves, mitral valve repair, or TAVR, it appears right now at least that the use of NOACs for these patients is acceptable. Structured follow-up for patients on chronic NOAC use is recommended. If we've learned anything from the use of warfarin over the years, it's obvious that these drugs, if taken improperly, are dangerous, both on the thrombotic side and the hemorrhage side. So it's important to continue to track the anticoagulation indication, making sure that laboratory studies like hemoglobin, renal, liver function, coagulation panel are checked at least once a year, that patients remain educated about the proper use of these agents, and that laboratory testing is continued, particularly for patients who may have changes in the way they clear these drugs, particularly renal insufficiency, hepatic insufficiency, and in the elderly. Third, it's important to know renal function when we use these drugs. The recommendation is to use the Cockcroft-Gault equation. This is used to properly dose NOACs. And NOACs are not recommended currently for patients who have a creatinine clearance less than 15 to 30 ml per minute or those on dialysis. But note, in the United States, apixaban is dosed based on the serum creatinine level, weight, and age. And this differs from the European recommendations. Also, be aware that apixaban and rivaroxaban are currently FDA approved in this country for patients on dialysis. A fourth point, which I think is very important, we need to check baseline liver function before starting NOACs. NOACs are contraindicated in patients with Child Pugh Category C hepatic insufficiency, and rivaroxaban is contraindicated in Child Pugh Category B hepatic insufficiency. So knowing the liver function and renal function with these agents is critical when we start them and also as we follow them. The fifth point is about switching. So when you switch from warfarin to a NOAC, generally the NOAC should be started when the INR is less than 2.5. When switching from a NOAC back to warfarin, warfarin should be started and the NOAC continued until the INR is typically above or around 2. You may want to repeat the INR 1 to 3 days later after stopping the NOAC to confirm that the INR is remaining therapeutic. The sixth point is also, I think, pretty important. We love the NOACs because they have fewer drug-drug interactions than with warfarin, but there are examples of this as well with the NOACs. For example, the P-glycoprotein and the CYP3A4 interacting medications are important. Examples include the following. We want to avoid concurrent use of dronedarone, rifampin, many of the HIV protease inhibitors, and the antifungals, itraconazole, ketoconazole, voriconazole, and finally St. John's wort and dexamethasone. So there are some drug-drug interactions that we have to pay attention to, even with the NOACs. A seventh item is the notion of in non-life-threatening major bleeding, plasma levels of the NOACs normally will come back to normal in 12 to 24 hours if the renal function is normal. But it can take longer if they have renal insufficiency, particularly with dabigatran, which is more importantly renally cleared than the others. In the case of a life-threatening major bleeding event, patients on dabigatran can receive the reversal agent idarucizumab, 5 milligrams IV in two doses separated by no more than 15 minutes. Patients taking factor 10A inhibitors should be given prothrombin complex. Obviously, patients receive supported measures. At this recent ACC meeting, there was a universal reversal agent presented. To my knowledge, this is not yet FDA approved, but hopefully within a year, we'll have a reversal agent for all of the currently available 10A inhibitors. Another question that comes up is how to deal with these after a major GI bleed. And generally, the NOACs can be started as early as 4 to 7 days. If the risk of stroke persists and it is felt that the risk of recurrent GI bleeding is low, particularly if the bleeding site has been identified and dealt with. Another point is that most patients can safely undergo surgical procedures after holding the NOAC for 24 to 48 hours pre-procedure. A longer hold time may be necessary for dabigatran patients with chronic kidney disease. And no bridging therapy is needed with these agents because they get to full dose right away. Typically, we want to resume full dose NOAC within 72 hours after the procedure, assuming the bleeding risk is at baseline. Another point is that patients who are taking a NOAC who present with an acute coronary syndrome, primary PCI can be performed. You may want to use a radial approach emergently for STEMI, and typically will delay for 24 to 40 hours in stable non-STEMI patients. Obviously, if they're on antiplatelet therapy and NOACs, then consider proton pump inhibition to reduce the risk of GI bleeding, especially in a patient who's hospitalized. For patients taking a NOAC with single or dual antiplatelet therapy, certainly shorter courses of the antiplatelet drugs would be recommended if possible to reduce the risk of bleeding. Patients, for instance, who have an elective PCI might benefit from dual therapy like NOAC plus clopidogrel from discharge through year one. Patients with acute coronary syndromes who undergo PCI should probably receive triple therapy for up to 3 months and then switch, preferably to an agent like clopidogrel plus NOAC for a year. After a year, then the patients typically would just be on NOAC monotherapy. For patients taking NOACs who present with an acute ischemic stroke, the risk of thrombolysis is real. And generally, we want to proceed with thrombolysis if the NOAC level plasma level is below the lower limit of detection, or the last intake was more than 48 hours before and the renal function is fine. Otherwise, we really want to think about thrombolysis in select patients after NOAC reversal or perhaps the use of endovascular therapy. For patients taking a NOAC who present with an acute ischemic stroke, we probably want to consider restarting the NOAC somewhere between 3 and 14 days. This really depends on your neurological assessment, the CT scan or MRI, whether there's any evidence of hemorrhagic transformation on the brain CT scans. So this European practical guide is available on the website, European Heart Journal, publication 2018. I thought it was excellent, and it certainly identifies a number of kind of key decision points for us in the management of these patients, and I recommend it to you. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org, and all of this information can be found on the American College of Cardiology website. You can find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, and I hope you have a great week.